I'd like to talk about opening up the meditation a bit further than we work with the breath and all of the energies of the body so far, the sensations. Remember last week when I told the story of Nasruddin and the donkey, and that we often pay attention to our ideas about things rather than the donkey itself. Beside the body sensations that we encounter as we begin to pay attention or be more present, another aspect of life you could call part of the donkey is that we begin to see a play of moods or states of mind and feelings in the heart that change and determine very much our experience. So you sit and sometimes you're bored or you're restless or you're afraid or you're sleepy or you're happy or you're in love or you're depressed. And those states arise for us and color the whole of our world. So that if you're in a rotten mood, you wake up and you're angry and depressed and so forth, it almost doesn't matter who comes in the door or who you see, there's something wrong with them. There's something you won't like about them. Do you know those days?
Yes.
Similarly, if you're in love, which one of my teachers, if you've fallen in love, one of my teachers used to call it falling in the well, actually, but we won't go into that now. You can be driving along and have a car accident and say, oh, it's just my car, you know, it's all right. The sensibility, the feelings, the flavors of our mind and our heart have a very powerful effect on what our life is like, almost more than the circumstances themselves. Now, as we begin to do a deeper meditation practice and start to listen and come into the present, we see the movements of the heart and the feelings. And often, what we initially encounter is difficult. Not always, but often it is. Just as initially there can be tension and sensations that have been held in the body that show themselves, so too in the mind. This is a poem from Kabir. He says, friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold to and keep spinning out. Kabir is an old, ancient Indian poet and spiritual writer. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day how well woven was its cloth. So I bought some burlap, but I still threw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to something, one after another. Kabir said, listen, my friends, there are very few that find the path, yet it's right here in front of us. So these different states and difficulties will arise, and we get entangled in them over and over again. You can start to see that in your meditation, your judgments, your fears, all those things. Evagrius, who was one of the Christian desert fathers, wrote a beautiful text in the 2nd century A.D. about the demons that attacked the meditators in the desert of the Sinai in Egypt. And they were the demons of desire and anger and pride and so forth. Sleepiness was called the noonday demon. Desire, I want to go back to Alexandria and have a pizza or whatever, souvlaki, whatever they sold in Alexandria. And then you get rid of those demons and you say, see how good I've done, and the demon of pride arises. So the next step is to begin to work with the different states which arise within us that determine our relationship to life as a part of the meditation itself, to take that which is here. Now, the Buddha gave, as an example, 5 common difficulties, 5 common entangling or difficult energies. They correspond to the demons that were found by Evagrius in Egypt 1,800 years ago. They correspond to old Hindu texts. And quite interestingly enough, the same demons appear to live in Marin County, and they get around these fellows. So the first of these difficult energies, and these are samples because these are some of the hardest, but you will find many others, and I'll talk about. The first of the common difficulties you encounter is desire. What's wrong with desire? We like desire. I mean, desire runs our life. We want things and then we get them. Why is it difficult? Desire for pleasant tastes or sounds or experiences or sensations. The problem with desire, there are a lot of meanings for it. In one way, there's desire that is simply the motivation to act that can be compassionate or wise. In this specific case, desire means what I translate as the if-only mind. It's the wanting mind that wants what's not here. If only I had one of those nice round zafus, or if I had one of those little meditation benches, then I could really meditate right. Or if only I had time to sit in the morning instead of going to work, or if only I could sit in the evening, or if only I had eaten, then this would be a better sitting. Or if only I hadn't eaten, you know? Or if only I was older, you know? I'm too young to do this. I've got a lot of things to finish up. If only I'd started when I was younger. I'm too old. Or if only I had the right relationship, someone to love me, then I could do my spiritual practice. Or if only I had more money or the right job. Do you know the if-only mind? And the problem with the if-only mind is that when it arises, it believes that what we seek deeply to make us complete is someplace else. When actually all we ever have is sight, sound, smells, taste, and physical and mental perceptions. It's here already. But we think, no, if I had that, then I will be satisfied. Does it work? What happens? You get it, and then what? You want the next thing. Because there is no end to desire. So you're sitting and wanting comes. If you get caught up in it, forget it. You're just lost and you get up and you order a pizza again or you eat something or you entertain yourself. So that's the desiring mind. Oscar Wilde put it this way. He said, I can resist anything but temptation. Right? And our society fools us. It says, if you get enough of this fast enough, I think I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, you know, if you have a beautiful dinner out and a good movie and great sex and a good night's sleep and a good jog in the morning and a fresh croissant and the right car and you do it all fast enough, you'll be happy. And really what happens is if you do it that fast, you get tired after a while. You just can't keep it up. The good life becomes ridiculous. Because what we seek is not what's outside. What we seek is something in our heart, in our inner sense, in our inner being. Now, how can we work with this? You sit and desire arises. How do you work with it in meditation? The same way we work with the sensations. If you work with it by suppressing it, is that any good? Not very useful. I mean, when you suppress stuff, what happens is it comes out some other place. It's because it's part of us. So you don't want to suppress it. On the other hand, you don't want to act it out. You don't? Well, if you are like me, and you acted out all of your desires, and all the rest of that stuff in there, they would lock you up. If you're like a normal person, right? So you don't want to suppress it, and you don't want to act all of it out. Neither of those is good. What's left is instead to begin to use it for insight or understanding, to learn from it, to find some freedom in relationship to it. So desire arises, and you sit, and here you name it. You say, wanting, wanting, or desire, desire, and you feel it. What's it like? If it's hunger, is the belly hungry? Or the tongue, or the mind, or the heart. Often we eat, but really it's our hearts lonely. So you begin to study what the force of desire is like that runs most of the world. For the first time, we're going to not just fulfill it, but sit and feel it and see its nature, watch it come, feel what it's like in the body, name it, desire, desire, desire. And after a while, what will happen? Guaranteed. Eventually, it will pass away. And then you'll see the next thing that comes. And you begin to see its impermanent nature, that you don't have to act on every thought or desire. Then you could choose. You have a different possibility, different freedom. Now in retreats, we have something that's called the Vipassana romance, where people will sit. They're all quiet and silent for 10 days and not supposed to look at one another. And then you notice out of the corner of your eye this form of this person, kind of attractive, you know, but you're not looking, right? You go and you sit. And you imagine, maybe meeting that person at the end of the retreat, talking with them, perhaps going off and meditating together or something like that, you know. And before you know it, you're married with kids, maybe divorced if you've watched the whole thing, and you've never even looked at this person in the eye. The capacity of wanting is very deep in us. So here you're going to study it instead of just being lost in it. Now, its opposite is the second of these difficult energies. And then instead of wanting, this is aversion, irritation, resistance, not liking, anger, ill will. It also includes some related states. Judgment. Has anyone noticed judgment in their mind? It's a kind of aversion. I don't like this. That's no good. You're doing it wrong. It includes fear. I don't want to feel this. I don't like this. It's a resistance. It includes boredom. Boredom says, I don't want what's here. I don't want to experience this. I want some other experience than what God has provided me in this moment. All of those are the states of resistance. And again, it becomes difficult to work with if we get caught in them. It becomes difficult to continue to meditate. And just like there is a Vipassana romance, there is as well at retreats something we call the Vipassana vendetta, where you can sit and there's somebody in that room that bothers you. They walk wrong, they eat wrong, you never talk to them, but they're wrong, right? And so you can have this whole fantasy of what you're going to do to them or why they are that way. And again, you've never even met this person. So you begin to work with this. And the way to work with it, again, the key strategy is to begin to face it. We have acted on our desire so long unconsciously without understanding it. We've acted on our fear or our anger or our judgment. So here when it comes, instead, you embrace it. And if you're angry, then you be angry. And you sit there and you note, angry, angry. Feel what is it like in the body. There's heat. It does a certain thing to the breath. There's a certain energy. Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is desire pleasant? You really look and see, is desire pleasant or is it painful? Quite an interesting study to see. Is anger pleasant? Is it painful? You begin to look at it and you name it, the name being a way to stay with it, as long as it's present. You note it. Now, we get really caught in the stories about things. And that's why we get angry. We think the world should be a particular way for us. Do you know the story of the Chinese man who's in a village, and he has a wife and son and daughter and a beautiful horse? Everyone says he's so lucky and he's the most prosperous man because he has a cart that the horse pulls and they can plow the fields and so forth. One day the horse runs away and they say, oh, he's so unfortunate. He had been fortunate, now he's unfortunate. He says, maybe. And wouldn't you know it, but a week later, the horse comes back and brings with it a wild stallion. He said, two horses, he's so fortunate. He says, maybe. He sends his son out to train the stallion to break it in, and in doing so, trying to ride it, the son falls off and breaks his leg badly. Your son in China is everything. He's so unfortunate. His son may limp and may not heal properly. It's such a shame what happened. He says, maybe. A couple weeks later, the emperor's army comes through town, recruiting all the young men to go fight against the barbarians. That's the war we're still fighting these days, right? And all the young men can go except one, of course, who's still healing from falling off the horse. And they say, oh, he's so fortunate. His son didn't go. And we could continue with the story. You get the point. We don't know. We have so many opinions about what is good and what's not. We just don't know. And sometimes what's not good is the very lesson we need. So in some way what's needed when you really study anger deeply, beside an acceptance of it and an understanding, which we're doing through the awareness, is a very deep movement of forgiveness. Because how do we know why this comes? And our opinions are really so temporal, they're so short. Now, fear is an interesting one. Most of us, when we're afraid, we just get afraid. When you meditate and fear arises, it's the same process. You sit and you note fear, and you feel it. What's it like in your body? The breath, the body sensation. But what does it do in the mind? Does it make the mind smaller or bigger? You face fear. Mullah Nasruddin said at one point, there's the story, he said, at one time I caused a whole tribe of Bedouins to run. And the friend said, well, how exactly did you do that, these wild, bloodthirsty Bedouins? He said, it was simple. I ran and they all ran after me. And this is a lot of the way that fear works. The farther we run, the faster the fear comes to follow us. So in this case, you're just going to sit, and fear comes, and you note fear. Fear, and you just feel it. And what happens is, after practicing for a while, maybe after 80 times or 250 times, fear will arise, you'll get afraid, you'll see what it does in the body, you'll note fear, you'll be scared, and then one day you'll be sitting and fear comes, and you'll feel it, and you'll note fear, and then it'll come the sense, oh, this is fear, I know you, hi, welcome. And it's as if the fear becomes one of your friends, because you've let yourself relate with attention to this that we usually run away from. So anger, fear, judgment, we'll talk about judgment more next week as well. Beginning to pay attention. Now, one thing about labeling the moods and emotions that come, if you pay attention and you label them kind of gently, fear, anger, desire, whatever it happens to be, you will discover that they don't last very long. Thoughts come quickly. Thoughts generally just, you know, one follows another. It can be just a few seconds. Body sensations tend to be a little slower. Moods are in the middle. And for the most part, feelings last, oh, there are two or three per minute. If you label it, rarely will a feeling last more than 15 labels. And then some other feeling will come. You see, you try it. Now, there are two more difficult energies that are paired just like wanting and avoiding that are common. The next two, in Sanskrit, tinamita is translated sloth and sluggishness, torpor, sleepiness. That's one side, and its opposite, which is restlessness. So you sit, and has anyone noticed that you feel sleepy sometimes? Again, it's a very powerful state. So what can you do with this? The first thing is you can begin to pay attention and not judge it or be afraid of it. Say, what does this sleepiness feel like, and what is it here to teach me? Sleepiness arises actually from three causes. First, it comes when you're tired. And a lot of people live lives that are hectic and often quite out of balance. And you sit in meditation and you get really sleepy and your body is telling you something. Give me some rest. Live in a saner way. Listen to it. It's, you know, it's smart. It's got something to tell you. Pay attention to it. So one thing is that it's simply a voice to respect from your body. Now, two other causes for sleep to arise. The second is sleepiness can come from being calm or concentrated. You start to feel your breath, you get a bit quieter, and all of a sudden you notice you're sleepy. It comes because the mind gets steady or quiet, and there isn't much energy. We're not used to being quiet and awake. You start to get concentrated or calm, and it's as if the mind says, gee, it's quiet in here, it must be bedtime. And it puts itself to sleep. Because our culture is such that we're generally only awake when the radio's on, and the movie's playing, and the drama's happening. And we don't live in such a way that we know how to be still and awake. And it's a wondrous thing to be able to do. But we don't know that. So part of the art of meditation is learning how to be still and bring a sensitivity and awareness to that. So that's the second reason. And with that, you can sit up straight, open your eyes, bring a little more energy, as well as pay attention to it. Now, the third reason sleepiness comes is interesting, is as a resistance. Sometimes you'll be sitting, and all of a sudden, some pain or some grief or some fear or something that's difficult will come, and you'll find yourself getting very sleepy, and you're not tired at all. You know that kind of sleepiness. It comes, the mind says, ooh, I don't want to feel this, let's go to sleep. So you might listen when sleep comes and ask, is there something cooking? Is that why it's there? Or am I sleepy? Or whatever. And then in seeing that, you can work with it. The way to work is first to note it, sleepy, sleepy, and pay attention so that you learn about that part of yourself, that energy, how it feels in the body and what it does. If you've labeled it for a while and you're still sleepy, then you can open your eyes or sit up straight or walk more briskly. I had a lot of sleepiness in my practice. My teacher had me walk backwards in the woods at night to stay awake. And then I'd still sit and I'd kind of fall, not asleep. So he said, all right, for you, you go sit on the edge of the well. Right? There's a well near your cottage. You sit there. And I did. And I'd start to nod in 50 feet of space, the adrenaline rush. All right. The fear will keep me away. So it's workable. You can work with it. You note it, and then if it's necessary, you bring a bit more energy. Now, its opposite is restlessness, worry. The same thing, what do? You feel restless, your body's restless, you can't stand it, it's too hard, you got to get up, vibration inside. You sit there and you note, restless, restless. We are so conditioned that when difficult things come, we get restless or lonely or bored. What do? We get up and we open the refrigerator, or we turn on the TV, or we call someone on the phone, or we distract ourselves. And so our whole life is running away from certain basic states of loneliness or boredom, restlessness or fear. Finally, in meditation, you're going to stop and find a place of greatness, of strength, of your being. So restlessness comes, you just label it, restless, restless, and feel what it's like. Now, what if it's really strong? What do then? Well, with sleepiness, you open your eyes, or you stand up, you can meditate standing up, or you walk. With restlessness, what you do is you die. You sit there and you say, okay, kill me, take me. And see what it does. You die of restlessness. Be the first yogi in Marin County to die of restlessness. And what happens in that moment where you say, all right, let me die of restlessness, take me, is that it all changes if you really do that. And it just kind of moves in some way. Because what makes these states so powerful is our resistance to them. And the moment you say, all right, let me die of it, it's not so bad. It doesn't have the same impact. It's the resistance to it that makes it so difficult. The fifth common energy is doubt. It's too hard. I can't do it. Everybody else can meditate but me. I can't concentrate. It's hard to sit still. It's the wrong time. Again, I'm too young. I'm too old. Maybe it's not the right practice. I should do something more entertaining, Sufi dancing or something. This is too boring. Or I want one of those Tibetan lamas, those guys in robes and so forth. I don't want an American teacher. I want one of those gurus or something like that, So it's doubts about yourself or the practice or the time and so forth. And the minute you believe it, you get caught in it. You cannot continue to pay attention. So what do? It comes, and again, doubting, paying attention to it, and letting it be part of the meditation. There are really two kinds of doubt. That's the small doubt. I can't do it, it's too hard, it's the wrong day, and so forth. You just label that. There's also something called the great doubt, which is the deeper questioning of who am I, or what is the nature of this heart and mind and consciousness that we're given. And this is the doubt or questioning that brings us to realization or understanding. There's a story which illustrates this from the Sufi tradition. There was a master who went to heaven and appeared at the pearly gates. There was an angel with a sword who said, go no further, O mortal, until you can prove to me your worthiness for entering into this paradise. And the master responded to him, how do I know this is a real heaven? And that you're a real angel and this is not just the delusions of my disordered mind undergoing the process of death. And before the angel could reply, a voice from inside the gates called out, let him in, he's one of us. This is the great doubt. This is the doubt that is not, I can't do it or it's too hard, but the doubt of what is true? Who am I? What can I really value? How can I live this life from the deepest place of my being or my heart? What is the meaning of living in freedom or liberation. And that's a valuable part of our practice. So I hope you can see that what we're beginning to do is work with all of the moods of the heart and mind. As you sit, not just these difficulties, but love, happiness, bliss, rapture will also arise. You can note that. Love, love, happiness, happiness, rapture, bliss. The point is not to suppress, but to open to what's there with awareness, with wisdom, and with kindness. We've cut ourselves off from so much in life, and we begin to understand this through the process of meditation and paying attention. Now, as you sit, also you'll discover, as I mentioned, not just tensions in the body, but tensions of the heart. There is very commonly unfinished business that will arise. If you have grief or sorrow, if you have loss, if you have forgiveness to do, if there's things that you still hold on to, all that will come. And you need to be able to sit and weep or note the grief. Let the heart open as it will. It's a difficult journey if you want to open, but the point of the journey is of opening, and the difficulties, in fact, are the journey. Most people think that if I get rid of these, then I can really meditate. And these are the meditation. These are what one Zen master called manure for bodhi, manure for enlightenment. You plow them under and it enriches your practice. It keeps the practice juicy and alive. There's one last story I want to tell as a way to illustrate working with this. I read an article recently in a magazine about parents who had started a network for disabled children. They'd been unable to have their own child, and so decided, rather than going through all the medical stuff, to adopt a baby. Since white Caucasian babies are hard to find, they looked to adopt a baby from a poor third world country. Went to India, adopted a child from South India, from a very poor area, and brought him home and loved him, but something was wrong. And after 6 months, they discovered that he had cerebral palsy and that he was profoundly deaf. And it was very sad and painful. The child would never walk. And what they did is they started to teach him sign language so he could hear. Through the words of their hands. They learned it themselves and they taught him. And then they got him a little wheelchair so he could move around in. And then they rode away to India, where he came from, and they asked to adopt a second child. And they requested, please, could we have another child who is deaf to keep this one company? An astonishing story. Here they had the most difficult situation. Parents with a child with cerebral palsy, paralyzed and deaf. And most of us would feel sorry for ourselves and feel all the struggle. What they did is they looked up and they said, please, I'll take a second one, thank you. An incredible spirit of acceptance of difficulty and working with it as part of the spirit of practice. What's important to realize is that it's not so much what we have or what experiences come to us in this life, but how we relate to them that creates our happiness or our sorrow, that creates fear or compassion. There's a good story from Mullah Nasruddin again that illustrates this. At one point, he was walking on the road and he saw an old man carrying a bag. This old man had retired, he'd had a fine life with his family and children and grandchildren, but he got bored and he wanted to travel around the world and find something new. He traveled around and he discovered there wasn't really much new, and he got more and more depressed seeing that everything was just how it was. And he was kind of walking down the road moping, and Nasruddin stopped him and he told him his story. And he said, so I have all of what's valuable with me here in this bag and I'm looking around for new experiences. But the world is just the way it is. Nasruddin, seeing his depression, reached out and grabbed the bag and took it from him and ran off in the woods. The man was quite dismayed and walked further down the road, yet more depressed. Nasruddin cut through the woods, knowing the territory, and came out on the road further down, where he placed the bag in the center of the road and then hid behind a tree. Some minutes later, the man came walking down the road more dejected and depressed than ever, really unhappy, he'd lost all his precious possessions. Then he sees the bag. He runs up to it and opens it, and all the valuables are still in it. And he starts laughing and jumping for joy. And Nasruddin steps from behind the tree and says, "Strange what it takes to make some people happy." He had the same thing before as he did afterward. That's true in our life. What matters is not what we have, I promise you that, but how we relate to it. So somebody on this earth has to learn that, because the forces of greed and hatred and so forth are so great. We're going to start to look at that. Let your eyes close as you sit. Your body comfortable again and erect, stable. Now the instructions will be to continue working with the breath as the center object, feeling it as carefully as you can, the actual sensations of the breath. The nose or belly or wherever. If body sensations are strong and call your awareness, then name them. Itching, tingling, hot, cold, pain, pain. If sounds arise and interrupt you, there's a loud car or someone coughs, then you can note those. Hearing, not the story or whether they're good or bad, but the bare act of hearing, until it passes away and then back to the breath. If any strong moods or feelings, love, fear, desire, anger, contentment, restlessness, doubt, bliss, if any strong moods arise, when they come, let go of the breath, feel them quite fully, experience what this is like, wanting, rapture, fear, naming them softly, fear, as long as it's present. Staying with it as long as it's there. When the feeling goes away, then returning back to the next breath. Being centered with the breath, the body, sounds, and the movements of the heart. Stay in the present. If the mind wanders off, come back to the breath, sensations, or the moods and feelings. Keep the labeling very simple. Let the naming be just 5% in the background. Simple name. mostly feel what is present, opening yourself to it with a careful, gentle awareness. Notice what's present just now. Now, for the last couple of minutes of this sitting, let go of the breath. Continue to pay attention. But shift your attention to note whatever feeling is present, even if it's quite subtle or mood. If it's peaceful, label it peaceful, peaceful. If it's restless, note restless. Sad or happy, whatever mood is present now, name it softly and see how long it lasts. How many labels? And then when it is past, name the next feeling that's present. After peaceful, it might turn to calm. Or sadness might turn to fear. Notice the next mood. So how was that for you? Were you able to note or be aware of the feelings or moods as well? That last minute or two where I asked you to note whatever feeling was present, what were the kinds of feelings that you noted? Just give the names. Sadness?
Sleepiness?
Quiet?
Excitement?
Worry?
Restlessness,
fear,
calm.
I found myself like feeling like I didn't feel anything, but I was like looking for something.
Mm-hmm. So then you could note quiet or empty. There's always something that's there, even if it's nothing. What?
Noting.
Did you get a sense in doing that, even when it's subtle, that it's possible still to give a name to it and to become aware of what the inner experience is? You can try again. Just note empty or whatever if that happens.
I have trouble putting names to certain.
If the name doesn't come easily, don't go looking through the dictionary or the thesaurus or whatever. Just note feeling. And generally names will come, and if they don't, it doesn't matter. What's more important is that you're just present and notice that it's there and when it changes. This gives you a whole new dimension of practice to work with beside the breath and the body. Now, sounds and even more than that, the sensations. And as I said, someone said fear, someone said worry, someone said sadness, people also said calm or happiness or excitement. If there's unfinished business, if there's sorrow or there's grief or there's lack of forgiveness or there's a conflict, that will come. And all of these things are really a part of the meditation. It's not like you get rid of these and then you can meditate. Mm-hmm. That's not the practice.
So I'm not really clear. When you're saying feeling that sadness comes up, are you saying allow yourself to get sad and cry? Or are you saying...
You could get cry if crying comes. You just let yourself feel it. And you note sad. If you feel it fully, you might cry. Or you might be sad and then after a little while, you label it sad. And you say, I hate feeling sad, and it changes to hating, or sad, and it dissolves, or sad, and then all of a sudden you realize that you feel very lonely, and the sadness is gone, and what's there is lonely. You feel that for a bit, and it goes away, and then you go back to your breath.
Well, but I misunderstood. I thought what you said that man over there was, it's about remembering. So
remembering means to be here, to recognize.
Right. So I thought I'm watching my breath, and then I have a feeling, mm-hmm. and I name it, and mm-hmm. I go back to my breath.
Yeah, and no. If the feeling is there, you let go of the breath, just as with body sensation. You name it as long as it's present. When it disappears, then you go back to your breath. Okay? So that's a little bit different, and I just didn't communicate it well. To be with each thing fully.
I don't know whether I said this right. I was just categorizing emotions into anger, pain, fear, one of these. Mm-hmm. And I was doing, oh, pain, pain, pain. And I thought, this isn't pain, this is angry. And so I went angry, angry, angry. Mm-hmm. And it was almost magical how it changed. And then there was an excitement. So I went to excitement, excitement, excitement. Mm-hmm. And that went to calm, calm.
Terrific.
But somewhere in there, should I have returned to the breath?
No, if those things... That was really juicy. There was a lot going on, so you could be aware of that. Similarly in the body, you might note a pain in your knee or something, pain, pain, and all of a sudden your hip starts to hurt. And so you feel that because it's quite strong, still going on. And then you feel a contraction, and you note the contraction, and then it sort of dissipates, and then you go back to the breath. So if it dissolves right away, then you go back to the breath. But if one feeling is followed by another that's strong, you could stay with it for a bit, just as you did. That's
but
perfect.
I didn't stay with it for a bit. I stayed with it the whole rest. I never did get back.
It's fine. That's all right. If there's strong feelings, just certain sittings, you may have a lot of body sensations. Certain times you may have a great deal of emotions. Other times you'll be much more with the breath. Now, if you feel like you're getting lost, that it's just getting too much, and often people in the beginning will have this experience, God, the breath and sounds and what should I be doing? If that is happening, go back to the breath and just be aware of the breath and only leave it if something is really strong and you can't avoid it. But if you're able to be aware, it actually the point is to be aware of what's present. Breath is one of those things. It may be half the time that you're here. Other time it would be sensation or feeling. They're all good. All right, let us just finish then. What's important, and this gives you something to practice or work with in this week ahead, is not so much the experience that you're aware of, but that you're beginning to develop this capacity to see and to face what is here. This is what develops what's called in meditation a greatness of heart, a capacity to live in the present. And somebody on this earth, as I said, needs to face greed and fear and hatred and anger and delusion and all those forces that create war and create so much sorrow on this earth. If we want to make any difference, somebody has to be willing to understand them and face them and see, what is that in myself before I go and try and change the world around? What is anger about? What does fear feel like? What is prejudice or delusion or grief or boredom? And to become fearless in the middle of it. Fearless doesn't mean that you don't have fear. Fearless means simply that you're really able to live your life and open to it in a direct way. And that's a wonderful thing about practice, is that through it, our capacity to feel and live and be alive grows. I want to end by reading a poem from Pablo Neruda, who is the Chilean poet who won the Nobel Prize, called Keeping Quiet. Now we will count to 12 and we will all keep still. For once on the face of this earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for a second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars of gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers and sisters in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead in winter and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go. It's a beautiful poem. It's really a poem about beginning to listen to these things which make up our life. And that's the next step in this process of meditation. Work with a daily sitting during this next week. Again, you don't learn it by coming here. This is the piano lesson, and you have to go home and practice. That's all. It makes it valuable. Otherwise, it's just entertainment in some fashion. Find a regular time and a regular place. If it's complicated, just go back to the breath. But if strong moods or feelings come, let those be part of what you work with. I'll tell you one last story, and then we go. My teacher Ajahn Chah, who I studied with, used to sit around and receive guests. And when I was going through a hard period in my practice, I didn't know how to label doubting very well early on. I was just having a hard time. And I went to him and I complained. I said, "You don't even seem so enlightened to me. I mean, the place doesn't run so well, and you talk all the time to these visitors. What kind of enlightened teacher are you?" And he said, "Well, it's good that I don't seem enlightened to you." I said, "Yeah, how come?" I wanted to go and leave and try a different monastery. Maybe I go to a Burmese monastery, which is like telling an Israeli you're going to go to an Arab monastery or something. But he thought it was pretty funny, you know, because Asians don't say those things. "What do you mean you're not enlightened?" I said, "Well, you don't seem that." He said, "It's a good thing. Because if I appeared enlightened to you, you'd still be caught in thinking you could find it outside of yourself. You can't find it. The Buddha's not out here," he said. "The only place you can find the Buddha is if you go back and sit in your own heart, in your own relation to life. It's not a process of imitation. It's really a process of discovery. And you are invited to do that through your practice."
This concludes the third class on the inner art of meditation. Our program continues with the fourth class in this five-part series with Jack Kornfield.
There's a story of Mullah Nasruddin, the Sufi fool and wise man and comedian and all that. He was out one day on his hands and knees, it was in the evening actually, under a lamppost, looking around in the sand for something. And a friend came by and said, "Mullah, what are you looking for?" And he said, "I've lost my key." So the friend got down on his hands and knees, and they looked for a long time through the sand, found nothing. Finally, his friend said, "Mullah, where exactly did you lose it?" And he said, "Well, actually, I lost it in the house, but there's more light out here." And in some way, in our culture and in our lives, even though that sounds kind of idiotic, we've been idiots of many kinds in our lives, we do that in that we look for solutions to the problem of our happiness or our fulfillment or coming to deep contentment or wakefulness or love or whatever in the wrong place, outside. Getting the right job, relationship, amount of money, clothes, weighing the right amount, more or less, or all these things. We look outside as if that is really going to solve the question of human happiness. And it doesn't get solved there. It's really solved in the heart and no place else. And you probably know as well as I do, people who are prosperous, rich, all kinds of blessings, who are happy, and people who are rich and prosperous and all kinds of blessings who are miserable. And on the other hand, people who have very little, who in that are still happy. And those who have very little and who have great difficulties outwardly and are miserable. And it's not a function of what's out there as much at all as how we relate to it. It's inside that we discover fear and greed and aggression and love and communion and the possibilities of living in some really conscious or awakened way. There's one more story I'll tell you of Mullah Nasruddin. He went in the bank one day to cash a check. And they said to him, "Could you please identify yourself?" So he reached in his pocket and he pulled out a small mirror. And he said, "Yup, that's me, all right." We have these ideas about ourselves. Often very limited. I'm a smart person, or I'm not so smart, or I'm a extrovert or an introvert, or a kind person or unkind, or I have these qualities and not those, that we've learned that are conditioned really from very early. And to begin to meditate is to look into ourselves and discover what's really there, apart from all our ideas and questions and the structures that we made of ourselves, but to discover in a deeper way what is possible in our life, what is possible in our hearts. Now the first thing, as I said in the beginning of the classes, the first thing that's necessary is simply to come and be present with ourselves, and that's why we started with the breath. Let me take a couple more minutes of questions or comments about what happened in your sitting this past week, and then we'll go on with our sitting and instruction and so forth. We got up to working with breath, body sensations, and then moods and emotions. Anyone else like to describe what happened or have questions? Please.
Well, when I was meditating today, something really strange happened with like my body feelings. It got to feel like I got to feel really huge, like, and it was like I was a piece of wood or stone, and mm-hmm. immense in size, and it reminded me of experiences I had when I was a child, like in bed, and I'd be sitting in bed for long periods of time, and I'd get those same weird feelings, and it was scary.
Yes.
And there was a feeling of nausea that went along with it, and I was thinking of opening my eyes and checking out of the meditation, and I just said, okay, I sort of had to reassure myself that my body didn't look like that, even though I didn't look.
Like Mr. Potato Man. Or
and so I just stuck with it and it went away.
Uh-huh. Did you name it? Were you able to do that
nausea,
at all?
Nausea.
Nausea, nausea. Uh-huh. Terrific. Fantastic. What you experienced was one of 100 different side effects that happen. Generally, they happen when we start to get quiet or when we start to get concentrated or when our senses somehow become more open in an inner way. And sometimes your body feels light and you have to open your eyes to peek and make sure you're still sitting on the ground. Sometimes it's heavy. It feels like stone or metal. Sometimes your breath feels like it's breathing over here or your nose is over there or you feel hot. And there is sometimes release of heat. There's a practice in Tibetan yoga called Tummo where you develop inner heat. And the monks would go out in the winter time and sit on the snow outside the monasteries and put wet blankets over their shoulders and see who could dry the blanket first with their body heat, just as kind of meditation contest. And this is really true. So sometimes you get release of tremendous heat or waves of cold. You get visions. You see lights and images that arise. And initially when all these things and many other side effects come, there can be a little bit of fright, like what's happening? It's out of control. I'm not, governing my life as I'd like to. In fact, it's always out of control. I mean, look at your mind. You say, don't think. Does it listen? Or please don't feel unpleasant feelings. I just want to feel love and happiness and joy and contentment. Does it listen? Your heart beats all by itself. You don't control it, thank God. Your liver does all the things it needs to. And so part of what you see as you meditate is the truth that most of our life is a stream that goes along that we don't direct. Initially, there's a little anxiety, quite natural. Simply, you could even note that. You could note anxious a bit, and then that'll pass away. And then sometimes it gets pleasant. You say, well, this is kind of far out. Let's see what it's like to be a stone or be huge or be tiny or something. And then the next danger comes after you're finished with the fear. is that you start to like it and you get attached. And you say, well, let's see, next time I sit, maybe I could do that again. If I breathe this way and sit just like I did before, I'll get it to come back. The key to working with the variety of unusual side effects is to do just what you said, to sit with them, to name them as best you can, see them for what they are, which is another play of the bodily senses, see the reaction if there is one, and then continue. You did very well with that. It may come back, or you may get a different thing instead. You never know what's going to come when you sit. You just sort of sit down and take what you get. Good. Someone else, please.
At one point, I felt very anxious, and I labeled it just like you said, and it subsided.
Mm-hmm.
Pleased by that. But another night, I was very, very tired, and I found it impossible to sit. I tried, it just could not do it, so I said, this is it, 3 weeks straight. I've had it, I can't do it.
Uh-huh. You did it every other night for 3 weeks, but the one that you were exhausted, you're probably ahead of most people in the class. So that's terrific.
Yeah, but why did I find it so terribly difficult to sit when I was that tired?
Because you were really exhausted, and it's natural. One of the things about sleep consciousness, which I said, I think, last week or the week before, is it doesn't have the ability to hold the body up. And when you get really exhausted, it isn't the best time to meditate. It's a good time to sleep, and then you could meditate when you wake up. So what you did intuitively was actually quite fine. All right, let's do our first sitting again for tonight. So find a way to sit which is comfortable and stable, where you feel that you can hold your body relatively still for this time. We'll sit about 15 minutes or so. And we'll continue with the instructions from last week, and then later on in the evening add or elaborate further to them. So when you sat up, steady and comfortable, let your eyes close gently. Let your back be straight enough so your breath can be easy and open. And first just come into your body and become aware of what is present for you. The reflection of the day in some sense. If there's obvious tension that you notice, you can soften that, letting the eyes and face be soft or the jaw relax. Letting the shoulders, arms, and hands be relaxed. Letting go in the chest and the belly, let the belly be soft. Notice whatever mood is present. Agitated, sleepy, peaceful. Just get a sense of it without judgment. And then in the midst of that, there are certain feelings, perhaps thoughts, sensations. Become aware again of the fact that you are breathing, of this movement of life breath. And use the movement of breath, feeling its sensations, letting it breathe itself, whatever rhythms it would like, as a way to bring the mind and body together, to be here in the present moment. as you pay attention to the breath, if there arise any strong sensations in the body, or any obvious moods, happy, sad, fearful, delighted, name what arises, leaving the breath aside and receiving that sensation or state of mind with the same open attention that you've used to watch the breath. Give it a label, itching, tingling, tinkling, sad, sad, whatever it is, and see what happens to it as you observe it. Does it continue for a while? Does it get stronger? Does it disappear? Stay with it, feeling it until it does pass away or you've been with it for some time. And then return back to be centered on the next breath. If you notice the mind has wandered off to fantasy or memory, when you're aware of that, let go of it and return back again to the breath or sensation that's here in the present moment. be aware of what is present, noticing with a gentle, careful attention. One more minute. How was that to come back together as a group and to sit again? It's easier? Mm-hmm. Please.
Yeah, I've been finding several times, after about 15 minutes, my body just involuntarily stopped.
Just
stretching,
get up.
And, you know, and it's like, and then I realize what I've done.
What happens probably is that you have a kind of attack of restlessness.